Thank you, Adam. So one of our core values here at New Denver is community. And we talk about it a lot with like D groups. We talk about community here, like in the body, but it can also refer to community with other churches and other believers in the city. So seeing that value, a couple of years ago, Stephen Redden, one of the pastors here, helped to create the Church Cooperative of Denver, a collection of just like-minded churches in the Denver metro. And so every year we get together and throughout the year we share resources and we share preaching, and every year we get together and do a shared preaching series. And so I'm really excited today to have Brandon Addison, pastor of the Neighborhood Church in Littleton, here today, and he's going to be preaching from the book of Proverbs. So, Brandon, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Good to be here. Like Taylor said, Brandon Addison, pastor of Neighborhood Church, west side of Littleton. We've been part of the church cooperative, and you can get Stephen and Dan and talk to them a little bit, because they called me a couple months ago. They go, hey, tell us about this neighborhood grant idea that you're doing in our community. We have a high value on hospitality. We want to create spaces for people. And so what we do in our church is, if you want to throw a block party or have something in the school for Mercy, we give funds to do that. And they had about a 2 or 3 minute call with me. And then I looked at your announcements this week and I'm like, oh, apply for a missional grant. I wonder where they got that idea. So go ahead and do that. It's a great thing to do, and I'm glad you're continuing that work as well. So I don't know probably any of you or at all, but I bet I know what your week had looked like. My week kind of started out like this. So Monday morning, I wake up. I'm slit-eyed a little bit, so I go and grab my coffee. I'm a little bit of a coffee connoisseur, so I get the 8.3 grams per cup and grind it and put it down. You may not do that, but you most likely like coffee. So you might do the hipster Corvus bean thing, or you might go ahead and go to Starbucks and get your white flat white while you drive in to some place around Denver where you do work. Now, if you're like me, what do you do with work? Is you begin and open up some sort of screen, most likely. It doesn't matter what type of screen that is, but you're on an Apple or an iOS or Android device, and you're beginning to work on that screen. This begins to sound a lot like Monday morning, doesn't it, for many of us? At some point in time between the coffeeing and the screening, we get hungry, and so something has to happen. Then we got to either cook food or chop vegetables or go through a drive-thru or pack our lunch. So some of our nights are spent prepping, doing things like this. Then after a long day of work and coffeeing and screening and eating, we have to taillights and get home. And we know the Denver commute is really difficult. And usually at this point in time when I'm stuck in traffic, you know what I begin to do? I begin to think about all the stuff I need to buy. And now granted, when I'm stuck in traffic, I'm not going to get off on an exit. I'm going to start looking on Amazon or Jet or whatever thing is, and usually in 2 days later, some boxes like this are going to land at my house. Now, after a long day of working and coffeeing and cooking and trafficking, usually you need to take the edge off. So we usually indulge in something at the end of the day. It may not be Monday, it may be Friday, to take the edge off. That might be Netflix or chocolate or concerts or other delicacies that have in the Denver area. And after the entire week of this, we have to put all this stuff somewhere. So it usually looks like this by the end of the week. Okay. Mass confession is good for the soul. If you participated in any of these activities, go ahead and raise your hand. Look around the room. That's mostly everybody. Now, what do these all have in common? These are all means of consumption. We are all consumers. It's weird to say as a pastor, isn't it? We are all consumers. We have to take things in to live and survive. Now, consumption has this negative connotation, doesn't it? It's like a taker more than a giver. When I think of consumption, I think of the Bronco fan who has his belly overhanging and maybe have a hot dog in hand. He's telling the defense to run faster or the offense to hit harder. Or maybe like I'm a gardener as well, so those Japanese beetles that go into your grapes and raspberries and just decimate our consumers. That's consumption. We have such a negative view of it. Or Urban Dictionary says it this way. A consumer, someone who buys things they don't need with money they don't have to impress people they don't like. Consumption. But here's the catch. we are all consumers. You consumed yesterday, you're going to consume today, you're going to consume next week. It's as natural as breathing, as air. And the question is, how do we consume wisely? If it's something we're always doing, how do we actually do it with wisdom? What does that look like? How do we redeem this whole term of consumption and actually use it for good and not just be on autopilot? And that's where we're going today in the book of Proverbs. If you have a Bible or a screen, we're going to be in Proverbs 31, 1 through 9. That's the tail end, the bookend of the book of Proverbs. You haven't been with us before. If you're new to New Denver, what we're doing this year, this summer, is we're going through the book of Proverbs collectively. There's 15 churches in the Denver area, and we're looking at Proverbs for this idea of wisdom. Now, wisdom is completely different than information. Information is Google, Siri, and Alexa. But wisdom is something you have to marinate and meditate on. What I've been telling my congregation in the neighborhood church is when I was at the age of 8, I remember my mom taking me to the candy store. And you can remember probably the candy stores with all the plexiglass candies. And I picked up one of those everlasting gobstopper stoppers or jawbreakers. And the difficulty is if you try to break down on that candy, it's probably going to break your teeth. So what I had to learn is just let it sit in my mouth and let the sweetness and the goodness drip down. And that's exactly what the Proverbs teach us to do. We have to let the sweetness and the wisdom drip into our souls as we meditate. It's going to be in Proverbs 31, 1 through 9 here, the tail end here. This is typically known as a Mother's Day sermon. Let me like redeem you of that. This is not a Mother's Day sermon by any stretch of the imagination. It's one of the last written, not by Solomon, but by King Lemuel. And what we'll find out, these are not his own words, but these are the words that are given to him by his mother. If you're a note taker too, I'll just go ahead and give you my outline. We're going to look at a beautiful nature of consumption, the shaping of consumption, and a direction for consumption. Nature, shaping, direction. Proverbs 31, let's jump in there. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women or your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It's not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their ministry no more. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the poor and the needy. So before we get in, you automatically see that these words are striking. There's three rhetorical questions, and there's two negations, two big no's. It's not for kings to drink strong wine. Do not give your strength to women. And some of you maybe who are peeking over the fence of Christianity go, exactly, I know where this is going. We're going to talk about consumption and how it's bad for us and how you shouldn't drink, smoke, or chew or date girls that do. The problem with Christianity is it's always against something. It's never for something. This is not what this text is about. So the first thing we have to do before we even jump into this nature of consumption is not focus on the negations and the no's, is to look at the beautiful nature of consumption. To consume means to be fundamentally human. It's like foundationally beautiful to consume. You look at the whole biblical story, Genesis 1, Adam and Eve are placed in a garden of abundance. And it says, be fruitful. And then in verse 29 in Genesis, it says, and God said, behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth and every tree with seeds and its fruit. You shall have them for food. From the very beginning of the garden, human history, God is telling us to consume. In the Old Testament, when Israel is wandering around in the wilderness, it's called a land flowing with milk and honey. Jesus, first miracle, it's a wedding at Cana. A lot of people are eating and drinking and reveling and consuming and celebrating. Church history, making room for people is typically done with hospitality, offering food and drink to others. The whole biblical story, the end of it, Revelation 21 and 22, is like the wedding supper of the Lamb. It's fundamentally beautiful and foundationally human to consume. There's a reason that most of us, we don't get our taste by our taste buds. It comes from our olfactory nerves. That's why when you get bacon on the pan and it begins to caramelize, or you get that crema on that cup of coffee, or a fresh pan of brownies are left out of the oven, and you begin to salivate and long for those things. I mean, there's a fundamental reason God did not design us to hook us up to a slop machine through our belly button and just instill food that way. Are you with me? Even look at this. This is the latest rendition of a coffee tasting profile. So any cup of coffee has this many tasting aromas, definitions. And now I'm not a math major, but there are 8 things in the center, 4 tastes, 4 aromas, and 64 variants. If you do an exponential of that, that's millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of coffee tasting wonderfulness, so to speak. It's fundamentally beautiful to consume. It's what we are called to do. It's how we're designed. But this is it. There's a power to the consumption. Consumption is not inherently neutral. It leads us somewhere, and that begins to get us into this proverb. Laura Hartman, who wrote a book called The Christian Consumer, says it this way. The flow of physical materials in and through human lives is morally and theologically complex. Whether consumers are aware of the complexity or not, all creatures must consume. Their moral import is likewise unavoidable. And for this reason, consumption bears serious ethical reflection. This is where we have to move, and this is where the proverb goes. Moving from beautiful nature of consumption to it actually shapes us. It takes us somewhere. Let's still get back into this proverb here. It says in verse 3, the first negation, do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. Then it says in verse 4, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink. And at first reading, you might go, oh, that's a good piece of moral wisdom, because the higher you are in society, you have a leadership position, if you're a president, if you have a CEO, a corner office, the moral fall and the moral fallout is more. So you probably should stay away and pigeon yourself from these certain substances. That's not what she's saying. This woman is so much more wise. It's so much more deeper than that. Verse 5, this is the beating heart of this proverb right here. If you're a Bible highlighter or marker, this is one to put down because it's often misunderstood. It says this, it's not for kings to drink wine, to give strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. This woman is saying, my son, my king, if you begin to overconsume substances, what will happen is you'll be more consumed about those things. You will not live out your responsibility as king. Instead of being a vocation of justice, you'll actually bring in injustice to those. It'll shape you in a certain direction. Your moral consumption has a shaping for your insides and your direction on life. There's a shaping to consumption is what she's saying. It's going to lead you somewhere. Now, we've kind of caught up with this. The Bible talked about this thousands of years ago. Hold on one second. Can you guys hear me in the back? I have small ears, so this thing is falling off left and right. We're finally catching up to this. What we found out in neuroscience, this is actually fundamentally true. Like, there's a neuro shaping to how we consume things. It's not just inputting. It actually changes the way we think. So let's take some things that we are typically tempted to consume in today's society. So let's talk about food. Let's talk about not just like carrot, quinoa, paleo, whatever you're on. Let's talk about donuts, cheesecake, frosting, and baking. So what they did 2 years ago, they had a bunch of rats. For 8 years, they gave rats healthy food. And then 8 years later, they introduced, they would say high fat, high sugar tolerant foods. So it was cake frosting, bacon, and cheesecake. They did a little a nuance. Every time a rat wanted the bacon, the frosting, or the cheesecake, it would get a little shock imported to its brain. And so they introduced this food, and they were shocked to learn that these rats gained 40% in body weight because they were all going towards the cheesecake and the frosting and the bacon. But that's not even the main part of the story. They were doing neurological scans on the rats. And what they were finding out is as the rats were introduced to all these foods, their neurological pathways were changing, actually creating them a deeper longing for sweets and bacon and frosting and creating that compulsive overeating. This is what they say. The more junk food they ate, the more they overloaded the brain's reward circuitries until they essentially crashed. As the pleasure centers in the brain became more and more blaze and less responsive, the rats quickly turned into compulsive overeaters. They are motivated to keep eating to get their fix. And what they're saying is, it wasn't just simply eating the cheesecake. It was changing the way and what they were longing for. So those are rats. Okay, I understand. It's a psychology study. We really can't base our science on rats. So let's talk about something else. Let's talk about technology. Let's talk about smartphones. So we, on average, check smartphones 82,000 times a year. That's one every 4 minutes. That's roughly four times since I began speaking. And what they've discovered, they did a study with Korean adolescents over the last 5 years, and they've discovered that the more you use your smartphone, the more problems persist. Depression, fear of missing out, longing for touch. But then this is what they say, and it goes into a mind shift change. It says this. They said, the philosophical maxim, I think, therefore I am, has been replaced with a digital motto, I connect, therefore I am, leading to a new status desire, I am liked, therefore I am. And then they said, this consumption of technology is changing the way we view about ourselves. So again, this is from the study of cyber psychology and behavior that came out a year ago, saying what we consume affects how we view ourselves. This is true of any other technology. In fact, let's do a little bit of a study right now on the spot. So I got two pictures of a smartphone in front of us. This is not mine, so don't read into these apps here. I don't have Ulysses or 1Password. But one is fundamentally more appealing, isn't it? That would be the left side, the one with the colors on it. So what's going on right now is you're looking at that smartphone picture on the left side. You notice the reds, the blues, the greens, the yellows, is the reward center in your brain is beginning to ping, and that's releasing dopamine, which creates this pleasure center, which makes this neurological pathway for you to go, this is good when I begin to look at this. And that begins to circle over and over and over again. It's true for Netflix, too, with binge watching 4.6 hours a night as well. So this is what begins to happen with our brains. Nicholas Carr says it this way. He wrote a fascinating book called The Shallows when he begins to examine his own life after 10 years of writing online and going, something's going on within me. What's happening here? He says, over the past few years, I've had an uncomfortable sense that someone or something has been tinkering with my brain. Remapping the neural circuitry, reprogramming the memory. My mind isn't going so far as I can tell, but it's changing. And she says, I'm not thinking the way I used to think. I can feel it most strongly when I'm reading. Immersing myself in a book or a lengthy article used to be easy. Now my concentration often starts to drift after two or three pages. And I think I know what's going on. For more than a decade, I've been spending a lot of time online searching and surfing the internet. And it's changing the ways I think. Okay, let's pause real quick. This is not a sermon on decreeing the evils of technology, okay? But this is beginning to show us that what we consume shapes the moral direction of who we are. That's exactly what neuroscience is saying. And that's exactly what this mother was telling us 2,000 years ago. What we consume shapes who we are. It was in verse 5, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of the afflicted. So your consumption is leading you somewhere. That's what this proverb is about. It's either leading you to goodness, more humanity, more empathy, or it's leading you someplace else, usually an escape, usually less human. So the question I've been asking myself, how do we use consumption towards moral goodness? How do we actually use it as a tool to make me more human and not less human? How do I not become a statistic on these different things? studies. And thankfully, this woman gives us a direction as well. She gives a direction for consumption, and it comes out in this beautiful literary phrase known as a double entendre. I love that word, by the way. Double entendre, it just rolls off your mouth like molasses. A double entendre is this. It's a phrase that has two meanings. So through this whole proverb, she's been telling her son, this king, not to open his mouth. Don't give to strong drink. Don't give your strength to women. Don't open your mouth. And then verse 8 and 9, she commands him to open his mouth. Look at that, verse 8 and 9. It says, open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of who all are destitute. And then it says, open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and the needy. I mean, Lemuel, open your mouth and be the king that you are called to be. And I don't care where you are in the political spectrum, obviously, but it says, judge righteously. Who does not want a leader and a person who judges and defends those who do not have a voice? She's giving a direction, saying, Lemuel, open your mouth for the sake of others, not for the sake of self-consumption. So this passage is not about moral negations. It's actually a vision for our vocation in our lives, how to consume and not be consumed by it, how to use our gifts for the sake of others. This wise mother's telling this king, don't use your office and all the privilege and all the luxuries for yourself. Don't work to bathe in luxuries. Use your job and all your ambition towards the goodness of the world. Now, how do we do that in 2018 when everything that's been created to us and given to us and marketed to us actually makes us want to self-actualize? Like, we need this for our own benefit. It'll happen tomorrow at Monday morning. It's called Prime Day on Amazon. They'll sell you products, and you'll have to buy those products because you think you need them. It's self-actualization. So how do we begin to consume wisely? And what I've thought about this week, I think for us as human beings, our level of consumption and our level of satisfaction are always correlated. They're always tied together. It's inescapable. The more fundamentally dissatisfied you are in who you are and where you are, the more tempted you are to overconsume. So the example is, the reason we binge on diets and gyms and look for the next fad and we're always looking at magazines is we're fundamentally dissatisfied with our bodies. Parents, the reason for some of us, we're always so busy with our children, going from activity to activity, looking at schools, trying to figure out to get an edge, is we are fundamentally dissatisfied with where we were in life. We want to give them an edge. The reason some of us are on all these different websites looking for the next connection is we're fundamentally dissatisfied with relationships. Some of us spiritually, we go from Bible study to reading group to neighborhood group or small group or series to series looking for a fix because we are dissatisfied spiritually where we are. Some of us consume contacts and networks and job boards and opportunities, and we're always looking over the fence for what's bigger and better because we're fundamentally dissatisfied with our job. We're in Colorado. Some of us, we go from experience to experience, from restaurant to restaurant, from activity to activity, from concert to excursion, because we're fundamentally dissatisfied with the mundane daily experiences of life. Our level of consumption is directly tied to our level of satisfaction. So the only way we can begin to consume wisely, and this may sound like a cliche, is we fundamentally begin to realize our satisfaction is found in God. First, we know the whole gospel story. It's a gospel issue, but the gospel story begins in Genesis 3, where Adam and Eve overconsumed and they ran away. So God begins to restore the world. And first, the first thing he does, he restores the world to himself through the person and work of Jesus Christ. And because of that, he can restore us to ourselves so we can fully know ourselves. And then he restores us to one another. That's called the church. And then eventually, one day, someday, the bigger part of the story is that God restores the world and all of its intentions to itself. And this is not just data. This is so our souls can be fundamentally satisfied in the person and the work of Jesus, and so we can consume and not be consumed by it. So we can consume and enjoy it and not be overtaken by it. Because most of us consume to escape the reality that is. One of the most tragic stories of consumption that I heard happened almost a decade ago in 2010 in South Korea. It was a young couple, 25 and 21, who had their first daughter, but began to get addicted to this video game called Anime. It would be an equivalent of Second Life, where you have a complete virtual life. You can build everything out that you need. You can have a job and a child and a family and create friends. But this began to snowball 2, 3, 4, 6, 8 hours a day. And what they began to do is they would go home and feed their daughter and come back and play the game. And something tragic happened in 2010 that after a long day of going to the internet cafe, they came back and their daughter had been she deceased. She was so malnourished that she died. And the police chief ironically said it this way. So the irony is they indulged themselves in the online game of raising a virtual character to escape reality, which led to the death of the real baby, which is actual reality. Now, this is a completely tragic story, and you are wicked and insane to do this. And I think we all realize this. This defies rationality, and it's easy to write this story off. But can you at least begin to see yourself in that story? The longing to consume, to escape reality instead of to live in reality, to live with life on life's terms? Because I think every time we look at a screen, we look at an email again, we get on a website, we grab the bottle, we pick up a piece of work when we don't need to, we open the fridge, we gorge on sugar. It's shaping us in certain ways. And I want us to be people who are free, not enslaved to do that. So a couple things. One, we are made to consume. It's fundamentally beautiful. And there's a moral shaping to that consumption. And we're going to consume this week. It's going to happen. It's going to happen this afternoon. Before we go on autopilot, we got to ask ourselves some questions. Are our souls satisfied in God, or is it looking for something else? And this week, when you're tempted to pick up the bottle, when you know you shouldn't pick up the bottle, when you've already had two of those, when you're tempted to open the fridge, when you know you shouldn't be opening the fridge at late at night, when you're tempted to get on a screen, we know you shouldn't be getting on a screen, when you're tempted to look at an email to make yourself feel important, when you know you need to be spending time other places, first, with a nanosecond, go stop and go, where's my satisfaction right now? And then secondly, go, all those longings are truly a deeper longing for God himself. It's a longing for identity, importance, satisfaction, connection there. Augustine said it this way, our hearts are restless until we find rest in him, O God. And I find myself like Mick Jagger instead of Augustine. In 1969, he wrote a song, I can't get no satisfaction, though I try and I try and I try. And that song has been played over and over and over again. And my hope today is we can begin to say, my satisfaction is found in God, and therefore I can consume for its benefits and not for the sake of my humanity and identity. Let us rest in the God who's come to us and who is redeeming us. Let me pray for us. God, we love you. Help us. Our hearts are wondrous, and we can't fully understand it. We are full of desires and longings and aches. God, we pray. We pray that we become a people who use consumption wisely. God, that you even in these moments convict us of places where we're running away from you and going to something else. God, help us in our frantic folly that at times we are like Mick Jagger, going around, going, I can't get no satisfaction. So I'm running to all these other things, and the answer is fundamentally right underneath our noses. It's the God who is there. God, be present with us. I pray for those who are peeking over the fence at Christianity who are curious as well. May they find you satisfying and rich.